Homemade listeners, we're taking a break for a couple of weeks to get ready for season two of the show. While we're away, I'm excited to share an episode from another fantastic podcast, Food and Wine Pros Communal Table. We'll join host Kat Kinsman as she talks with Chef Timothy Hollingsworth about kitchen intensity, belonging, and cooking for your mom. I know you're going to enjoy this one.
Hello, beautiful people. You are listening to the Communal Table Podcast, part of Food and Wine Pro. I'm your host, Kat Kinsman, and I wanted to offer a little bit of context about this week's episode, which was recorded really in the before times, as we're calling it now, months and months ago. Timothy Hollingsworth came in to the studio and we got to sit together and talk. And I'd wanted to speak with him for a long time. I've been fascinated by his career. I had first gotten to know about him when I read Andrew Friedman's really incredible book, Knives at Dawn, where Tim was the head of the Bocuse d'Or team for the United States. And I, you know, began to learn so much more about him and his work at French Laundry and his commitment to his craft and his passion. I have so many questions about the world of fine dining. And, you know, even more so when I was approached to have him as a guest, I was told that he spent a lot of time connecting with his mother who has dementia and cooking with her. And that really, really spoke to me because I know that situation, or I knew that situation really well. You'll hear us talk about it a lot in the podcast, but some things have changed in all our lives since then. In particular, for me, I'm talking a lot about my mother in the present tense during this, and connection with food, and just the, you know, the act of getting, of sitting with somebody who maybe can't express themselves like they used to, isn't always in control of their memory, and their faculties might have a hard time swallowing or something, and still somehow being able to connect over a meal somehow. And you know, Tim does that a lot with his family, as you'll hear in the podcast. Since then, I lost my mother to COVID-19, and you know, I'm still putting a lot of things together in my head about sort of how to express this, how to write about it, what our connection through food was, and I'll have a story coming out soon about that. But I still wanted to run this conversation. Life feels a lot more fleeting and precious in some ways than it did before. Everything changed so much. Those connections are absolutely vital. And I've been thinking a lot about all those times that I took for granted, meals with friends and family and just being able to gather together over a meal together. And, you know, I don't know when a lot of us will be able to do that. I know so many of us have lost loved ones, during this, and we won't be able to do that again, with them. And I really wanted to, again, still have this conversation because it's so important to focus in on those moments of connection while you still have them. And I also wanted to still run this conversation because we talked a lot about restaurants. He's got multiple restaurants, Odium and CJ Boyd's and Free Play in LA. And, you know, he's just hearing him talk about that and how they've become a real family endeavor for him has been so exciting. You know, everything is on hold in restaurants right now. We don't know what the future of restaurants is going to be, but I still think there's so much value in visiting a conversation where we were talking about what actually goes into running one and his particular path towards opening these restaurants, because he had come from such the rarefied air of the Thomas Keller empire. And we also in the podcast discuss a certain amount about, you know, we're both food professionals in our various ways, and at times didn't necessarily feel comfortable in places. Like, maybe this wasn't necessarily for us. And if we feel that way, how do other diners feel? So I just wanted to offer that as context. I think I got a little bit teary during it. But hey, if we can't express our emotions right now, when can we? So here's Timothy Hollingsworth.
Hello, beautiful people. You are listening to Communal Table, part of Food & Wine Pro. Okay, my guest here today, he was at French Laundry for a long damn time. He won Final Table on Netflix. He's got Odium Restaurant. He has a slew of other places that we will talk about. He's got a line of chefware called Based. And just, you know, I've read about him for a long time before I met him because he was on the Bocuse d'Or team. And just somebody whose rigor and intellect and passion I've been so interested in. For a long time. Welcome, Tim Hollingsworth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my gosh. Tim, it is... wait, are you Tim or Timothy?
Actually, just, well, I don't care.
Okay, because for ages, Timothy Hollingsworth and stuff, but then like all the emails were Tim. But it's so funny to meet a person who I've read so much about because I read Knives Before Dawn, which... could you please tell people about Knives Before Dawn and the experience of doing the Bocuse d'Or and what the Bocuse d'Or is? Because that's intense.
Yeah, I mean, it's technically not, but it's pretty much the Culinary Olympics.
Yeah.
So it's a.
You
it's
train.
Trained. I actually got off a little easy because I did it. I basically was brought on very late in the process, a lot later than a lot of other people. So normally people spend about 2 years or longer training and definitely like a year solid of like cooking the food that they're going to be doing. And I was I found out in September of 2008 that I won the last day in September, and then I competed in January. So it was a short process for me.
Tiny window. But like I remember reading this book. It's by Andrew Friedman, and it is so intense, and you were locked in an apartment doing this. Like there was a whole apartment kitchen set up for this. And could you explain to people like sort of what this is exactly, this culinary competition? Because I find it so fascinating.
I mean, it's like a throwback. I mean, you're like literally making a fish and a meat. This is the format when I competed.
Yeah, it's very European.
Yes, fish and a meat, and then you have three different kind of garnishes, but really they're complete dishes. You parade it on a platter.
No, there are theatrics to this.
Yeah, you parade it on a platter. My platter like lit up. I had like these beautiful glass, like hand-blown glass globes that like had smoke inside of it. Yeah, it was pretty intense, but it's a difficult competition. It's 5.5 hours long, and you have to do the fish, and then you have to do the meat, and then when the fish goes up and gets paraded around, comes back to you, you have to plate it all.
And there's an audience screaming.
Screaming. Like Switzerland has like cowbells. It's like no joke. It's pretty loud. It's really loud.
I've seen some of the live feed of it. I've watched this before, and to hear like different nations chant, and all this, it really does feel like a sporting event.
It does.
I mean, I can't even imagine how you manage the physical exhaustion of that. Has to be so intense, but the mental strength it must take to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised. I talked to Gavin after Gavin did it the time before me.
Gavin Kaysen.
Yeah. So Gavin Kaysen, who's now the president of Bocuse d'Or, mentor. So he's recently been promoted. He's awesome. So he did it the time before I did. It's a 2-year competition, happens every 2 years. And he basically lobbied to get Danielle involved and Thomas involved. And like Mr. Bocuse, you know, got Thomas and Danielle involved as well. So all of them, and that was the first year that I competed. So I competed in 2009, and that's the first year that they kind of really took over the sort of American competition.
Well, it showed up in the placement too.
Yeah.
As America had never placed anywhere near that before.
No, that was the first time. So it was really cool. It was cool to be a part of it. I'm glad, you know, there's been many amazing chefs, and now we've reached the gold. So it's like it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it was a fascinating book. For I mean, I feel like people who like sports would actually love this book.
Yeah, I mean, cooking is a lot like sports. You know, it's like in the team in the kitchen and all that kind of stuff. The hierarchy. How do you motivate people? It's very much likely to us, like a sports team.
It really. I've heard that Dave Barron was in here, and he was saying about he had all of a sudden was he. I'm blanking on his sport, what it was, but it was
probably hockey.
Yes, yes, and that that team mentality and was really such an important thing, and the discipline of it too. But speaking of discipline, okay, so you're doing this competition, but that kind of precision is not new to you because you were at French Laundry. So, talk to me about that. How about that whole arc? Because you were there for 13 years, and you know, very arguably, truly one of the most precise kitchens in the United States of America. And in fact, it's one of those flagship kitchens where people sort of coming up and thinking, I want to be a chef. And they're looking to there. Everybody wants to stage there. Everybody wants to work there because of the reputation and the training. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I spent a long time there, obviously. With that comes, like, starting out as a young kid.
How old were you when you started there?
I applied when I was 20, maybe 19 even.
How much experience did you have at that point?
I got a job as a dishwasher on my 18th birthday.
Wow. Yeah. Happy birthday to me. You're a dishwasher. You're a dish dog now.
Exactly. So I moved away from construction. I did construction with my father and then got
Where
a job.
Were you living
at I that lived point? In Northern California. It was Placerville, if you know, in between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe. So I lived up there and I worked for a guy named Christian Moss, and he was from south of France, from Valence, where Anne-Sophie Pique is. I think he actually worked for Jacques Pique, which is her father, which is pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, it was working at the French Laundry was amazing. It was a lot of work when I got there, like even applying there, I was probably like really young and naive and like, you know, being like, okay, I can belong here. And then getting there and being like, oh my God, what is this?
Yeah. Oh, you hear that reaction from people. Cause they, you know, you get the job and then you show up and you're bottom of the ladder as a dishwasher and dishwasher there. What does dishwasher at French Laundry mean? What
so I got a job as a dishwasher when I was 18 at another restaurant. That was my first restaurant job. So I got a job as a commis or prep cook at the French Laundry. That was my first position. What does that mean? That means you do all of the grunt work. Every bit of it.
So let's talk through what that means for typical service at French Laundry.
Yeah, I mean, you get there, your clock in time is basically 5:30, which means you arrived at 4:30, and you're pretty much done at 5:30. This is, you know, kind of back in the day where you worked longer hours, and things were different in the kitchen, but, you know, you're supposed to finish at 5:30, sometimes you finish at 7:30, so it was like long days, but it was long days because you wanted it to be long days. You know, like I would stay. I remember I would stay and I would work, do my shift, do everything I was supposed to do, and then like stay and like help the guy that was like running behind. Mm-hmm. And it was only I wanted to learn. I wanted to, you know, I needed to progress faster. Mm-hmm. I needed to have more underneath my belt. So,
what was the thing that was driving you in that? Because you said you needed to. What is the need thing there?
I don't know. You know, I think the fear of failure. Maybe you know, I think. Wanting to be successful, wanting to be, you know, wanting to fit in, wanting to having goals. But my goals weren't like really like strong set goals. You know, they were more just not wanting things, like not wanting to fail, not wanting to be not, you know, like those kind of things.
And is it pressure from you? Do you feel so? I'm just so fascinated by this kitchen because I have read so much about it. Whose eyes are on you? Is it the person ahead of you? Is Thomas Keller ever looking in your direction when you're doing that? Does he know who, say, a commis is at this point? Like, does he look and be like, oh, knows your name?
I mean, he expedited every single service I worked pretty much.
That's
incredible. Like, for years. I mean, at the beginning, literally every single service, he was there.
Yeah.
That was before Per Se, so French Laundry was really his only thing. And you know, he was on the pass. He was on the pass every single day. He was intense. He was hard. He was very like he motivated. But literally one of the hardest working people I've ever met. He was there every single day. I mean, we would finish service and he'd be like, Tim, what fish do we have in the walk-in? And I'd be like, well, we have salmon, we have striped bass, we have, the, you know, he'd be like, bring me all the striped bass. Okay, bring it to him. Well, bring me all the salmon. And he literally, after service, after he expedited the line, and he might, if it was a weekend, he might have expedited lunch as well, then expedited dinner, and then broke down a fish after service. It's like,
that is a hell of an education in culinary, and that is somebody who you're thinking, because in so many other professions, the goal is to get to a certain point where you don't have to be there all of that time. You're trying to make yourself where you just don't have to be there. What's the word? It's the end of the week. Yeah. And you're trying to obsolete. Sorry,
obsolete,
you're trying to make yourself. Yes. But instead, if you're there, and is that because? I mean, that place is obviously so tied to him. It's his name, it's his reputation, or coming from a place of like, just this is what I do. This is who I am. I don't know what air I'm breathing if it's not kitchen air.
I mean, I think it's a philosophy thing. I think mm-hmm. it's the idea of like, I want to be better. I want to mm-hmm. constantly be better. I want to surround myself with people that are better than me. Like, it was a very encouraging kitchen to be around. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, some people didn't fit into that environment. Yeah. The culture was extremely strong there.
Let's talk about what that is. Like, what that culture thing is there. So, you know, is it a thing where it's, you weed out people who – so when you say fit in and fit and stuff, does that mean – how you act, what you do.
Everything. How you dress. I mean, your black shoes, black sock, black pants. Like, mm-hmm. it's from how you dress to how you look. Like, I, mm-hmm. you know, I have a beard now. I never had a beard there.
Yeah.
You know, I worked there for 13 years. I never had facial hair.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. Because, so that's such an interesting thing because
it's militant.
Yes. Yeah. That is definitely a thing because when I think of it, you know, I still have never been. It's weird. I hold it in my head as a place where my dad has always he loves food and he loves these things and he's read about French Laundry for such a long time and he's like, oh, you know, I want to go. And right now, and we will get to this later in the conversation. He can't really leave my mother right now too because she's not in a place where that can happen. And my sister and I, you know, sort of have long thought like, well, we want to take him to French Laundry finally at some point when that is a thing. But it's one of those things where even for people who do not regular restaurant goers, they don't live in a city where that is a thing. It's one of those bucket list kind of places.
It is.
So that's got to add some to that pressure of it too, because I'm sure there are people who can afford to eat there all the time. And then there's people who, this is the one time
it is,
in their entire life that they're going to.
I mean, I remember it was 10 years after working there that my parents finally came and ate.
Oh my goodness.
So I was a chef at that point, but it was amazing to have my parents. Like, I mean, you miss a lot of things, right? Like, it's a huge commitment in life. You miss birthdays, you miss, like, holidays. And not because it's like, you know, because, I mean, you're working hard. You want to learn. You want to progress. It's not like it wasn't, it was, I guess, technically required in the sense that we were open. Mm-hmm. The restaurant was open, but it was, you know, it was a huge commitment. So to be able to have my family finally come and, like, enjoy it and see, like, you know, what I was doing was incredible.
What had been the thing that was keeping them from coming before?
I mean, I think it's just an intimidating place, not really understanding. My dad's blue collar, like construction. Mm-hmm. My brother works with them doing construction. Both me and my other brother worked when we were kids with my father as well. And I remember it wasn't until he came and watched me practice for the Bocuse d'Or. So that means at that point I had been cooking for a decade. Mm-hmm. And he came and he watched me practice. And that was like the moment where I was like, oh, wow. Like my dad finally understands what I'm doing. He finally respects what I'm doing.
Wow.
Because before it was like, oh, you're in the kitchen. Like your mom cooks, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because it is cooking at that kind of level is a physical act. It is a sport. It's that kind of thing. And I'm so interested in this, and I talk about this with people all the time. You know, I'm a person, I work at Food & Wine. I'm a senior editor at Food & Wine, and I still will sometimes walk into a place and have that moment of tension, of nervousness. Mm-hmm. They're going to know I'm riffraff. You know, they're going to know that I don't belong here. I'm a, you know, kid from Kentucky, you know, they're, you know, goth girl from Kentucky. They're going to know that I don't belong here. They're going to know that I'm going to screw up a word on the wine list or something like that. And I feel intimidated sometimes. And, you know, now I'm much better about it, but still, like, when I come in with friends to some of these places, it breaks my heart to see when they are nervous, if they feel like this isn't a place for me, this doesn't, you know, and you see the kitchens, and or not the kitchen, but like the front of house that makes you feel like, no, this is for everyone. And they have that ESP, that kind of thing where they can sniff it and see what kind of night you want to have.
Yeah.
And that's,
they make you feel so comfortable. It's amazing. Yeah. I mean, there's people in my tenure there, but it's so true. It's like, those, they did such an amazing job. I mean, French Laundry is like one of the places, the bucket list place. It's like maybe you're going to go there one time in your life kind of restaurant, right? For a lot of people. So like those people that come in are spending more money than they ever would on a meal.
Yes.
And, you know, don't belong there, you know, to a certain extent, like, or feel like they don't belong there. But ultimately, that's what hospitality is. It's like when you receive that guest and you like really make them feel welcome. Yeah. I mean, Larry Nadeau was there my whole tenure before and after. And he's one of the guys that I constantly quote and inspired by because he has that ability. He has that ability to be able to take you on that journey and make you feel like you do belong here. This is all about you right now.
It is such a skill to have. And I have to say, I've never really so much talked about this before. I went to Per Se once, and it affected me really emotionally. Kind of, I was depressed for a week after because I didn't feel like I belonged somehow, like all the other. And I was sort of trying to break that down. Like, is this about me? Is this about them? Like, what is this thing? Mm-hmm. We were a table of four women, and I was sort of trying to piece it out because, like, I know the skill that goes in there. I know all of this kind of stuff. And it was because I was trying to figure out how much I brought to the table of this. And I realized where it broke down was the wine list discussion, where for some reason, the person who was working that night, I didn't know how to, I don't know, we were having a hard time opening up the conversation because it comes to money at that point. And finally, like, how much do you want to spend on wine?
What's your budget?
Yeah. And I sort of got the sense that because we were not spending nearly probably as much as other places. Three of us like were food writers and one person wasn't a food writer, but she, you know, was the person who went out to restaurants all the time and stuff like that. But I will also, and I don't know if this is a factor or not or whatever, but a woman of color. And so we were sort of like looking around and we were seeing like very, there are a lot of uncles, quote unquote, like out with their daughters. Yeah. And a certain amount of that are people who were doing like really intense wine service. And we knew that we couldn't do that. I also was, and again, like I bring stuff to the table. I also knew this was the most to date by $6 that I'd ever spent on a meal. I'd been to Alinea like actually a few weeks before that and had the best meal of my entire life, this crazy emotional thing where they were doing this like emotional magic where they were trying to figure it out. And the psalm was this guy who somebody listening to this will know exactly who I'm talking about, with big crazy Einstein hair. And he just his radar for the experience we wanted to have was so intense because I saw him at some tables where it was very serious and it was very whatever. And he saw us and he could tell we wanted to just like have fun and stuff. And it like matched it accordingly. So I went into it with that and I was thinking, we're going to Per Se. I'd built it up so much in my head and it was $6 more than I'd ever. There was no reason that was fit right in there. And I left feeling sort of like, I think I was looking at other tables thinking, are they getting better service? Are they, and now I don't look at other tables. I don't give a shit. Like, I was a younger diner too, but I felt I was so acute of the fact that I should be having the time of my life and there's something here that's not letting me do that.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that about French Laundry.
Yeah. I really think it comes down to the person. That's why like hiring staff and the training of them and stuff like that is really, really important. But ultimately, that one person makes a break. Like the food wasn't any different.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's the same as every other table, you know, or maybe a little bit more attention or whatever. But like at the end of the day, like that person delivering it, the messenger, the ambassador for the cuisine is really the person that can set that experience apart.
Yeah.
That's their job. I mean.
Yeah. And I think having that radar of being able to tell if somebody is nervous about this thing or not.
Yeah.
And one of my dearest friends in the world, John Winterman, was maitre d' at Danielle for a long time, and he has that thing. And he would always tell me about like he would seat somebody who he knew that they had scraped together all of their money, and this was the only time they were going to do it. And and he would sit them next to Mick Jagger because he was like, "This is my VIP for the night. Let's figure out like who that person is who's not spending all that much, or you know, they're not going to opt for the crazy wine pairing, or they might because it's the one time they know they're going to be there, and that kind of thing. They were not shuttled off to Siberia. You can tell when you've been shuttled off to Siberia.
Yes, you can.
And again, like I'm at a point in my dining or whatever, where like I really do not give a shit. Like it does not occur to me. It's just, you know, when I was younger, I I've never cared about getting the best table or whatever, but like you can tell when, you know, something's kind of off.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's an awesome philosophy. I mean, it's true. I mean, you sit next to Mick Jagger. I mean, I remember in a restaurant in Hawaii, I sat next to Elton John. I was like,
Whoa.
Oh my God, this is pretty amazing. It's Elton John.
I would always ask John about like that, Danielle, like, you know, who do you have in tonight? kind of thing. And it's such a thing, but like, and I would say like, he's so good at service because he never forgets that he's from Indiana. He's a kid from Indiana and has that acute thing about, you know, sensing with people. And I think that's such a special thing to have.
It's an art.
Yeah,
it really
is. But in the kitchen, when you're there, every plate's got to be the same, whether they're – what was your VIP term there?
It was VIP. I mean, it was
– no PX or like any of that.
No, I mean, it was – we literally said VIP. I'm trying to think, yeah.
Is there like extra extra something? Or?
Yeah, super VIP.
But that's – I mean, you have this incredible foundation of all of this stuff. And do you have a life while you're doing this?
No, I mean, you lived and breathed like what you did. I mean, like even – we would close – so the French Laundry would close in the summer in the winter for 2 weeks and the summer for a week. Per se did the opposite, winter a week and summer 2 weeks. But I would go and travel. I would go to France and I would go to work. So I would go to England and I would go work. Mm-hmm. And that was my opportunity to see other kitchens, to see like parts of the world.
I love that because, I mean, I'm a person who – I don't know what to do if I'm not working. I can turn anything into work. You know, I travel and it turns into work. And, you know, my husband is like, please, can this maybe not be a work thing? I'm like, but my work is fun and it's restaurants and, you know, I can't not. I'm trying to be better about that.
But I think it's like, for me, I'm the same way. But, but for me, it's like, it's not work. It's what I enjoy doing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I enjoy going to restaurants. And yes, sometimes it's work. But, you know, when you go and you plan a trip and you like the whole trip is not around museums or the culture. Yeah. It is the culture, but it's like the food culture of that place. I mean, it's like, is that work? Yeah, sure. It's work. It's technically work. But ultimately, you know, it's what I want to do. You know, I love doing it.
It is really great. Like with my husband and me, like our breakdown is like he loves architecture and I love food. I mean, and we both, you know, love that, but we sort of structure it all around there. So it's actually really a lovely, and I'm sort of reflective about this right now because yesterday was the 15th anniversary of our first date. So I like, thank you. I'm very excited. Like we're going to Blue Hill Stone Barns tonight and like, and it's, you know, it's just
that's one of my favorite meals recently.
It's
a really, really special place.
God, it really, truly is.
Yeah.
Like, and they're a kitchen that it sort of feels like that must be akin because you're so in tune with the seasons in such an incredible way. I mean, what you know, did at French Laundry and that you have like moved forward with as well is that just being on a rhythm with nature in that very particular kind of way, having the garden right out back, having the farm like right there. So what year did you start there?
2001.
Okay. So you're really, you know, California is light years ahead of the rest of the country in this, you know, in a very like, you know, Alice Waters, Thomas Keller and all, you know, Jeremiah, you know, Tower, like, you know, all of this kind of way where you're so in sync with nature in a particular way. Is that something that you had thought about before you got there?
No, not really. I mean, I grew up eating, you know, humble beginnings, my mom cooked, you know, really every meal for us. She was a stay-at-home mom. We have five kids in our family. And so, you know, food was a very big part of our life, but not from a ceremonial type experience. Just like, you know, it just was.
Get everybody fed.
And, you know, she cooked, she baked, she packed my school lunch until I was – you know, until I graduated high school, literally, like
that's
every single
lovely.
Day, she would give me a lunch. And I'd trade the homemade cookies for like Oreos or whatever.
Oh my God. I have to say, the Thomas Keller Oreos are the best cookie in the world. Oh God, they're so good. I worked at CNN for a long time and there was a Bouchon there. Mm-hmm. And my colleague, Sarah Latrine, and I would call it Bouchame, because we were like, are you going to Bouchame again today? like are you going to go and buy the like expensive and perfect sandwich today? Yeah. Are you going to get the TKO? Yeah.
I have to.
I bought dog treats there too. It's just so good. But yeah, those Oreos. Did you ever, I don't know how much like pastry and savory ever intersect there, but did you ever have insight into making those cookies?
No, I mean, no, because I was done at the bakery, but I did work pastry at the French Laundry.
I pretty much
worked every position. I mean,
wow.
For a time, they were short in pastry. I was a sous chef at that point, and so I went over and I helped in pastry. It was more, I worked service more than production.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did do some production. I learned how to do chocolates. I learned how to do, which is, like, not easy. And it's a lot of things that go into it.
It's
tempering and all that kind of stuff. And at my first position, you know, I learned to make pastries as well. So I did, like, fruit tarts, gâteau Saint-Honoré, lemon tarts, success, like, all the different types of, like, French pastries.
That is unusual and wonderful because, like, I love chef desserts where it's like a savory chef and they think, I've got to put a dessert on the menu or something like that. I inevitably love them. I mean, I all hail the pastry chefs because, like, that is such intense craft.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like restaurants are skimping on pastry chefs, like that sort of a trend, like, who's going to go first? Oh, pastry department. Yeah. And that breaks my heart because, holy crap, are there some intensely talented pastry chefs out there?
There are. There really are. And it's like, it's not, that's not an easy position. That's like, that's all about, like, that's the exact opposite of, like, what I do. I mean, that's like measuring every single, you know, I'm like,
it's chemistry.
I'm like, cook by feel.
right. I mean, but yeah, that's the thing. Like, so what kind of cook had you been before you got there?
I mean, I was the best in the, you know, my hometown, like cooking, like the highest restaurant. I was, and it really wasn't about my ability to cook more, just like sort of work ethic that my dad instilled in me. So I would work long hours. I would try to be, I was competitive. I played sports. So I tried to be better than the next person, you know. I like goofed off a lot too. So I was the guy that was kind of making jokes and running around with people. But it was, you know, it was, I don't know. I was constantly reading and trying to learn. I remember that. I remember, you know, I'd wake up in the morning. I was just so inspired. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was thinking about going to the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately, like,
I think you kind of did.
Exactly. But I was like, okay, well, you know, I think cooking is going to be for me. So I was like, okay, what does that mean? So that means, you know, I need to study. I need to be better. Like, what do? I woke up in the morning. I read cookbooks. I went to work on my break. Mm-hmm. I read cookbooks at home. I read cookbooks before I went to bed. I just, like, dove right in. I don't know. When you really love what you do, it's like it just embodies you.
So cookbooks, got it. What are some of these books that you have? Do you have like Fernand Pointe? You have like what is your canon there that you're reading when you're in your 20s, your teens, your 20s or whatever? What were the fundamentals that you had?
I mean, I was reading. So I trained underneath a pretty classically trained French chef. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was reading like Escoffier.
Yeah.
I was reading Le Repertoire de la Cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
I actually like studied French in community college in order to be able to read the books, because the books he had was in French.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, so I would, you know.
Some Michel Brun there.
But Thomas Keller, you know, I think the French Laundry Cookbook was one of the first books that I ever bought. And that was it's like the Bible. It's like, you know, reading that book was
hell
just,
yeah. That is a foundational cookbook.
Great Chefs of France. I don't know if you've ever seen that book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that book is like, that's probably one of my favorite, you know, 1978, about all the three Michelin star restaurants.
God, I could nerd out forever about these cookbooks. It's been really interesting, too, to see, like, what's coming back into print now, too. Like, mm-hmm. Claudia Fleming's book coming back into print is such a glorious, glorious
thing. Should.
It's so, and, like, every pastry chef I talk to, like, that was their Bible. There are some of these books where I buy used copies of things or I've been lucky enough to stumble over an old copy of it. So you're there, or you're getting these books and you're training and doing all of these kind of things. And, you know, you finally make it and then you're moving up and up and up to French Laundry. Does it ever occur to you, at what point does it start to occur to you, like, maybe there's a life beyond this particular place?
I mean, I gave, when I started there, I gave myself a year and a half. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, okay, a year and a half, I'm going to go. I'll go work for somebody else. I'll move on. But I just kind of like kept extending my time. Yeah, I mean, it's it really is like an amazing place to work, and the mm-hmm. tools that you have, and your ability to be successful there. I mean, yeah. if you it's a culture, so you have to fit in too. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some talented people that didn't necessarily fit into that environment as yeah. well that have moved on, but ultimately that environment really suited me.
Yeah, yeah, and so when it's time to leave there, did you know what was coming next? I mean, I'm sure you had a gazillion offers on the table, and also a lot of eyeballs on you. What's mm-hmm. he doing next? I know I was watching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what does that feel and look like? Do you give yourself some time?
I give myself time. I took a couple years off probably. I don't know the exact timeline, mm-hmm. but I left and that conversation with Thomas was probably a year conversation.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, yes. I gave, you know, he's a mentor, you know, like, oh, yeah. Chef, what do I do? What are mm-hmm. the opportunities? Like talking through it. So, you know, I wanted to go to either San Francisco, New York or LA. And LA just seemed to kind of fit. It was the right yeah. time for me to go there. Right time in sort of food, but ultimately, you know, I went down there. I didn't have a job.
Yeah.
I just like kind of left and decompressed. I consulted in yeah. Lebanon, Korea, and a little bit in yeah. Los Angeles. And when you're in that environment, you don't necessarily have the time to think about what you want necessarily.
No, because you're part of an organism or
yeah.
a machine or something like that. And you have to go in there, click into the Borg
yeah.
and, you know, and not think or want. You can't want so much.
Yeah. I mean, Thomas is, you know, arguably one of the most successful chefs mm-hmm. that has ever lived. Mm-hmm. And he's really like very successful, right? But that doesn't mean that that's the path that I want to take.
Absolutely.
That doesn't mean that that's success to me.
Yeah.
You know, so I had to really think about like what would make me want to be, you know, what did I want in life? Well, you know, I knew I wanted a family,
mm-hmm.
you know, I knew I wanted kids, you yeah. know, so like, how do I balance
by that point?
When I moved to LA is, actually probably maybe 8 months before I moved to LA, I met my now wife,
yeah.
Who we were dating at the time, and like kind
she
of
in the industry.
She's not in the industry at all.
Oh, I mean, well, see,
now she kind of is because she's like
yeah,
right
you
now.
Get to, you get conscripted
yes.
into it, but it's dating is so hard in restaurants because those hours are batshit, and you need to have somebody who is going to understand the fact that like you can't go to that family event.
Yeah.
You can't do that, or you tell yourself that you can't go to that funeral.
Yeah.
You tell yourself that. And
what are you doing for New Year's? I'm working.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel like then, you know, meeting your wife, it was that, because you had already, you said the conversation took a long time. Was that sort of a crack of light in the door? Like, hey, maybe I want to, maybe there's another route for me.
Yeah. I mean, I talked to him, like, I was like, look, I stood behind the stove. I ran one of the best restaurants in the country. And I worked really hard, but ultimately I didn't want to do that anymore. I didn't
yeah.
want to, it's not that I didn't want to have a restaurant. It's not that I didn't want to cook. I just didn't want to, I didn't want to be so committed
yeah.
to doing that because I had done that and I wanted more balance in life. You know, that balance was
yeah.
something that was a deliberate goal in my life to be like, okay, I love what I do,
yeah.
but there's more to life than what I'm doing.
So then you have an opportunity to start from scratch, build a team.
Yeah.
So what did that look like to you?
And it was tough. You know, you work so hard with so many talented people, and then you sort of decompress and you lose track of a lot of those
right?
people. And then all of a sudden, 2 years later, you're going to open a restaurant and you're like, okay, well,
mm-hmm.
I don't know any of the purveyors in LA.
right.
I don't have a lot of the contacts I used to have, like
right.
all that kind of thing. So it was really difficult. You know, I was lucky to have a few people that I worked with in mm-hmm. the past that that helped me through that process and joined the team. So without a team, you can't do anything, right?
Like Avengers Assemble. You figure out like, okay, so who is, you know, who's going to be my Hulk? Who's going to be my Iron Man? Sorry, I think about Marvel a lot. So I apologize for that. But then also, obviously you knew a lot about the, you know, the front of house, the service staff at French Laundry. So then you have an opportunity for that at the new place. So was that your responsibility? How hiring for front of house as well, or getting somebody in.
I mean, I did every single thing, which was actually really cool because, you know, I'm a creative person, artistic person, you know, developing dishes and stuff like that, and developing service. But like, I've always done it in somebody else's format, right?
Yeah.
So to have the opportunity to be able to do it and be like, okay, well, now it's my format. What is that format? Right. Like, that's a tough question to ask yourself. You know, you've experienced a lot of different things. Like, you ask yourself, what is a restaurant? Well, a restaurant needs to be part of the community, right?
Yeah.
Like, it needs to.
Everybody would say right on that. And some people are like, screw that. We'll just have the, like, you know, people come in.
Yeah. I don't know. But for me, that's what it was, right? Like, I wanted my kids to run around a restaurant. Like, the first restaurant that I worked out, the family lived in the back. And, like, you know, the kids would come home from school and I would be making them, like filet with like hot sauce.
I love restaurant kids. I have to say, like, all my friends who have restaurants and have kids, those kids are the best eaters in the world. They're so adventurous. I remember taking my friend's kids to like Michelin starred place and they're like ordering, you know, the most adventurous stuff on the menu. And I loved it. Mm-hmm. It was such a cool thing. And they were so well behaved. And then we got to the point in the evening where I remember the little girl like putting her head on the table and going to sleep. I'm like, that is the best option. That is really great. Great. Yeah. And because she wasn't going to like cause a fuss, she was just going to like, and I'm done now. And that was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you go to Odeum, like, and my family's close, like they'll be there and they'll be running around in a restaurant. And I love that. I think that helps create the culture of the restaurant, you know, help creates the environment, helps to create the family sort of environment and the team environment. We work hard in restaurants, you know, it's like, it's long hours. It's a very passionate industry. You're putting a lot into it. So to be able to, you know, the kids are life, like, you know, you like to see your little kid running around and to people feel that it's, I think it adds to the restaurant.
So you said you wanted to have kids and you have a bunch now.
How many do you have?
How old are they?
I have three kids. So I have two girls and a boy. My eldest daughter is 4. Mm-hmm. My son is 2. He'll be 3 in March. And then I have a new baby, River, who's just born 10 weeks ago.
Oh, little bitties.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. They're going to eat so well. They're going to be
so,
like, do you have a notion, like, in your fantasy? I know you probably don't want to force kids into a particular career or whatever, but like, do you picture them running the restaurant someday?
I have to show you a video after we're done with this conversation, but I just posted on my Instagram. But my wife took it while I was here.
Yeah.
And we went to Lyon this past year for Bocuse d'Or in 2019. And it's my first time back since competing.
Whoa.
But we went to Trois Gros restaurant, which is amazing. Really, really incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cesar and Michelle gave us basically like hats and aprons and whatever. And so yesterday she sent me a video and they're like playing in their little like toy kitchen and like picking up, like one's like making eggs and the other one's like making cupcakes. And it's like, I'm like, what? Like, this is like crazy. Like, and they're like moving around like they're chefs. Like,
that's so lovely.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's such a really, really cool thing. And like, props to your wife, too.
Yes.
Like, that's a lot of kids to have.
Yeah.
Like, that. Wow. That's really incredible. And
hey, everyone. I'm Sid Evans, editor-in-chief of Southern Living and host of Biscuits and Jam. Since 2020, I've been interviewing musicians, chefs, authors, and other Southern icons about their family traditions, their faith, their favorite meals, and of course, what it means to be Southern. And I'm excited to announce season 5 of our award-winning podcast. Join me every Tuesday for new conversations with some of the most interesting and influential Southerners around. Be sure to follow Biscuits and Jam wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us online at southernliving.com/biscuitsandjam.
But speaking of family, you and I have some similarities here, mm-hmm. that we've both got mothers with degenerative illnesses, and that's a really tough one. And you were saying that your mom made all the meals growing up, packed your lunches and stuff. So if you're comfortable talking about it, let's talk about it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my mom was sort of the rock for our family. I mean, my dad worked and went out of town and came home on a weekend sometimes. You know, he was a very hard worker. Mm-hmm. He had to work for 5 kids and like to raise us.
That's
like, you know, I mean, he was awesome. He taught me that work, I think. But my mom was the person that really sort of held the family together.
Yeah.
and still, like, my family's pretty close. Like, we go back on holidays and you know, probably, like, 3 times a year at least, and they come down and visit me. Mm-hmm. But, like, we're trying – if it weren't for my mom, I don't know that that would exist. You know, yeah. Sometimes I think about it now, and I'm like, man, that's scary. Like, who's going to be that person after mom?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But she was
– that emotional labor that goes on in any family.
Yeah. Yeah. But she's – you know, she was – like – I didn't think that I grew up, like, I felt out of place as a chef. I felt out of place, mm-hmm. like, you know, all these people, like, they work for, like, some of the best chefs. And here I am, like, brand new working, you know, working at the French Laundry. I didn't really feel like I belonged. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, like, years later, I kind of realized, like, oh, wait, no, food was actually a big part of my life.
Yeah.
And food was the reason that I'm close with my brothers and sisters is because mm-hmm. every day we had chores to, like, help out in the kitchen and, like, you know, wash the dishes, set the table, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. And we sat as a family and had dinner, mm-hmm. Which is, like, so important. It's very, very much a part of my life now too with my own family. But I think that time is, like, so, so important. You know, it's before cell phones, before all that, yeah. But it's like, you're sitting around the table and you're like, you're communicating.
Yeah. You know, that time's kind of sacred.
Yeah. It's forced communication. Like, mm-hmm. you don't really realize it, but, like, if you don't have that, or if you're, like, in front of your phone, like, mm-hmm. you know, you just sort of kind of go into your own world, you know, you lose connection a little bit. And I think that connection with my family currently, exists because of how we were raised.
Yeah. It is such a big thing. Mm-hmm. And then to have a parent who, you know, you start to see the signs. Like, for my mother, it's been a really long time coming. Like, she's been sick in various ways my entire life. And mm-hmm. for decades, she was having TIAs, which is these transient ischemic attacks. I think that's how it is. But basically, it's like mini strokes that turn your brain into Swiss cheese, basically. Yeah. And that's a crass way to say it, but I've heard, you know, look at scans, and that's what that is. Like, in addition to, like, Parkinson's, Lewy body dementia kind of thing. And you see this person, I don't know what phase your mother is at, but where they're slipping. Yeah. And you start to see that. And, you know, with my mother, there's motor control things, and being able to eat even is a challenge for her. So if you're comfortable talking about it, you know, with your mother going through this, you know, you start to see it. Is she still cooking? What is she doing?
No, I mean, we've gone to, I mean, the sort of stages, you know, we cook together. I would come home and, like, and make the holiday meals with mm-hmm. her. You know, at first I would like, cook my own way and cook my own things and try to, like, do different things.
Hey, chef boy.
Yeah, and then ultimately I was like, no, like, you know, what my family wants and what I want to eat is actually what my mom made.
Yeah.
You know, so now, you know, I'll go home and I'll make Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. you know, or Christmas, and we'll have what my mom used to make and, mm-hmm. you know, all the sort of classics. And, you know, we would cook together, you know, for years, and then, you know, then she would sit on the other side of the kitchen and sit at the bar and, like, watch and, like, be like, hey, mom, sit down. Like, you know, I'll do it. And, like, she'd be a part of it. And now she's not, you know, she might just kind of sit there blankly, you know, which is really, really tough. But I'm very thankful in the sense that she remembers us. It's not like she knows my kids. She might not be able to list her kids. She might not mm-hmm. be able to list my 3 kids, but she knows. She's got the wherewithal, you know. Mm-hmm. But she doesn't she can't, you know, her motor skills, like you talked about, like, if she, you know, if there's a plate of food in front of her and a fork and a knife, you know, it's like, you know, I take her hand and, like, here's your fork, mom, you know.
Yeah.
Like, this is your beans, pick it up, you know, like, eat it.
Yeah. That's a really humbling thing, is feeding your parent.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know, with my mother, it's, you know, there's motor control things. Yeah. She can't always swallow. So she's, you know, I've been a terrible daughter and haven't been down there for a little while and stuff. So I don't know what phase it is, but, she's somebody who, because her neck muscles and her throat muscles and stuff are because of her particular thing, swallowing is really, really hard. Yeah. So she has to have a certain amount of liquid things. And one of the other residents just didn't know and gave her part of a peanut butter sandwich that nearly killed her because she almost choked on it. And that's But I remember being there and she was in the hospital and like helping her, like, you know, eat the applesauce or something. And you're just like, God damn, no yeah. one prepares you for that.
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, my mom, like, I'm a mama's boy, you know, like,
yeah.
At heart. But it's, you know, that's the hardest. It's literally the hardest thing.
Yeah.
The hardest.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, you know, and only, I think only other people, other people who have been through this, know this thing, because my mother doesn't always know mm-hmm. who I am. So, you know, when she knows who it is and says my name, like, yeah. holy shit. I had this moment, this really, really particular, like, when she could still go to restaurants, because, yeah. like, her, you know, she can't. Move around really. So mm-hmm. she's in a nursing home and, you know, she and my dad are still together and he goes mm-hmm. and sees her every day and, taking them to this place. There's a Southern cafeteria chain called K&W mm-hmm. and their average clientele is like 80 years old and I love it. So, you know, you can bring an older person and somebody with mobility issues uh-huh. there and there's a lot of soft food uh-huh. and all of this. And, you know, I married a Southerner uh-huh. and, you know, and got introduced to this particular cafeteria chain. It's so funny. It's K&W. People joke that it's Canes and Walkers. Cause you go in there. And it's really
like a real thing.
Yeah, it's so funny. And they will carry your trays for you. And it's like, you can feed a family of six for like $20 there. And uh-huh. My husband's mother has passed away, but, you know, she went up there until her mid-90s and mm-hmm. it was kind of great. But I was going to, they had moved to South Carolina and I took them to the K&W in their town. And she got, you know, she couldn't really eat much, but I remember she had gotten some like pie that looked really, really good to her and like to have some bites of that and to take my parents to this place that has, you know, become so important to me was yeah. such a great thing. And I still remember like she, you know, said my name on that particular day. So yeah. it's so like fused in there with that. And you have to like grab those moments.
Yeah, hang on to them.
Yeah. Yeah, you really, really do. And I don't have kids, but you do. So are you teaching, well, I guess they're really young and stuff, but like teach them her recipes and
100%. I mean, my wife makes the banana bread that my grandma or the banana pudding that my grandma used to make and then my mom used to make. One of my favorite things that my mom made as a kid and into my adult life when I would come home every single time she'd mm-hmm. make it for me was her banana bread recipe.
Yeah.
And now my wife makes it and my kids make mm-hmm. it with my wife and I make it. You know, like it's something that that's what food has that ability, you know,
yeah.
like it brings you together. It brings you back in time. You know, mm-hmm. you think about having that, like now, you know, if my mom comes over, my wife will make it for me, like for my mom.
It's just,
my mom's like, oh, I used to make this. And you're like, yeah, like, mom, like
yeah.
you used to make it for me every time I come home.
Yeah, and it's the reminding of the like mm-hmm. saying like this is the, you know, this is the thing. Or is she a person who like wrote down recipes? Do you have like cards to, or like
I
out
do.
Of magazines or
I
any
do.
Of that stuff?
Yeah, and she had beautiful handwriting.
God, those cards are amazing, right?
Yeah, my sister actually gave me a I think it's from my sister, but she gave me my older sister gave me a towel, like a kitchen towel.
Yeah.
And it had like my mom's handwriting recipe on it.
Whoa.
Which is like really, really cool. And like, you know, I mean, it's special, you know?
Oh my, those things are really, really special. And like a friend of mine who, she had lost her dad to, Parkinson's and she had his handwriting like tattooed on, yeah. on her in this really special way. And there's a particular, phrase that my mother said to me that really stuck with me. And it was a moment where we had been afraid we were going to lose her like right then and everybody left the room and I'd been feeding her something. And then she said this line to me and I'm like, that's going to go, it's in my body already. It's going to go on my body
yeah, yeah.
at some point. That, I mean, that's an incredible thing to have those taste memories. And
yeah. My little sister, the tattoos, it's I love you. And it's my mom's handwriting.
Yeah. Those are really important things to have. And it's, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't know. It's really lovely. I don't know if you've encountered this or not, or if this is part of your mother's condition. This was a thing that actually I really thought was beautiful. That the person who was like the dietitian at the place where my mother is was talking about the dignity and food. Because you don't want to be a grown up eating baby food. Yeah. And so many people have to. And there's been I love that there's a department at NYU that works on this too. And what they've been able to do is take things and probably learn a lot from like molecular gastronomy and stuff, and take the puree and then form it back into food.
Yeah.
So you might have like a pea puree and somebody can't digest a pea or they can't do whatever, but they reform it back into a pea.
Yeah.
I think that's so good. That brings somebody their dignity back to eat food that looks like food.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you're, I mean, my mom, she says it all the time. She's like, I'm so cuckoo. I'm so nuts. Like, you know, like, and you're like, no, mom, like, you're good. Like, you know, like, don't say that. Like, you know, but I think just the ability to be, you just, she doesn't feel normal. She doesn't feel like she fits in. She feels like, you know, people are helping her. She feels like it's like, like, you don't want your mom to feel like that's like
it's
the
humiliating.
Worst.
Yeah. It feels like, and I like there. I'm very, very interested in the people who are doing the work to make like the utensils that are corrective. So if you have a tremor, it makes it so somebody with a tremor can hold a fork, and it's like the fork is still.
Yeah,
I think that's such an incredible,
it's brilliant
thing. Yeah, and I mean, I have more and more friends. You get to an age and your friends are dealing with this, who are dealing with degenerative stuff or dementia or whatever it is. And I feel like we're kind of the, you know, I don't know how old you are, I'm Gen X, and, you know, and but we're getting to this place where our parents are going through that. And, you know, and like, I don't have kids, but, you know, the sandwich generation, they call it. And I really do think some of the best things you can do is to, you know, be the conduit of those memories.
Yeah.
And, you know, neither my sister nor I have kids, but my husband has a giant family and he was a surprise. So his siblings are, you know, his older sister is like 19 years older than him. So we have all these grandnieces and nephews and stuff. And so I've sort of made a point of, I got his mother's cookbooks when she died, and you know, we have her recipes. So we're like, you know, holding on to these particular recipes, and there are the things that have to happen in holidays.
Yeah.
And like, holidays are that really particular time where those things happen.
Yeah. I literally cook exactly what my mom made.
Yeah.
Or like now cooking for my kids and making, you know, like, you know, I'm making chicken and dumplings. Like, I grew up
that I've learned how to make my husband's grandmother's chicken and dumplings.
Yeah.
And it's never going to taste exactly like hers, but we served it at our wedding. That was really fun.
That's awesome.
So with your chicken and dumplings, what school of thought are the dumplings? Are they the rolled ones? Are they the drop ones?
Drop.
Yeah.
Yeah, drop, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, biscuits and gravy, like, I learned to make it with my mom. Like, you know, I made...
Is she Southern?
Yeah, so we were born, I was born in Texas, so, you know, a lot of the cooking that she did was Southern, like Sunday pot roast, chicken and dumplings, Texas chili, like...
Oh, man. Yeah,
good stuff.
That stuff's so
stuff
good.
Stuff that puts meat on your bones.
Oh, my God. I absolutely love this stuff. Like, a good good biscuit. Like, do you make biscuits?
I love biscuits. I make them all the time,
are you lard, butter? Like, what's your jam here?
I mean, I grew up eating Crisco, right?
Yeah, so many of us did.
But, yeah, I do butter now. Lard is great, but I think butter is just something that I have in my fridge, so like I use it, but you know, I'm even though there's a lot of different types of biscuits that are, you know, are quote unquote better out there, I make my mom's style biscuit. It's like a drop biscuit, and you know, it's, to me, if I'm gonna have biscuits and gravy, like, I don't want a fluffy like risen biscuit. I don't want like a soft biscuit. I want like a sort of harder kind of drop biscuit, you know. I love it, and it's I don't know, it's we you know, you grow up, you eat a certain way, like, you, when you, as you get older, you kind of realize that you kind of go back to like your roots, and I think it's really special.
So you know, you're doing all these things, you're partnering with the great charitable partner with all the kind of stuff. What is the thing, I always sort of ask people, this is a question I ask everybody, because I believe in saying things out loud so somebody can hear it and help you, and maybe even help you articulate it to yourself. What is the selfish thing that you want?
The selfish thing that I want?
Yeah.
Like, in what way?
It can be on a great big level. It can be an end goal kind of thing, because, you know, you're doing these things. You're building a life for your kids. You're taking care of your mom. You're doing all of these things. What's the thing you want for you?
Oh, I just want my kids to be happy. I want to be like a good father. I want to be able to like, I want to be proud of like how I raised them, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, having kids is it's like frightening. You know, it's like you're responsible for these things, and you know, like you remember like your struggles as a kid, like your struggles, you know, growing up and trying to find a career and and all that kind of stuff. I'm lucky that I kind of fell into what I do now, but and I love it. But you know, I want them to be successful. So for me, like a lot of my life revolves around them and and their time and their upbringing. You know, I would love to have a ranch one day.
Oh.
You know, I mean, I think I am starting one in Los Angeles.
You're building a compound.
Yeah, but I, you know, we recently bought a house a couple years ago. Now, and we have like I have a German Shorthaired Pointer and a Rhodesian Ridgeback, so two giant dogs.
Yeah, I'm a big dog person myself.
We have seven chickens. Like and we're like 10 minutes from downtown, so it's like slowly I feel myself. When I bought the house, I was like, oh man, you know what I wanted? I've always wanted to have like fruit trees in the house, whatever. So I literally planted like 50 trees on the property. I'm not exaggerating.
That's going to pay off. That's that long-term kind of thing. Oh my God.
My wife's like, oh, congratulations. You got one apple.
Yeah. I know. I grow the worst, most disgusting apples in the world. The deer around us are so happy. We call them crapples. Like they're so hideous. And I get like one pair a year and have these like horrifying grapes that grow in upstate New York. Like it's god awful. I actually have like joke on Instagram. I have an ongoing Instagram joke about my disgusting fruit. Uh-huh. it's so much fun to be terrible at something.
It is. Pretty... I'm a pretty bad gardener. I'm actually getting better at it. Wife is like, you're going to plant a garden? Like, she's like, who's going to take care of it? Like, you kill everything.
You're training the children for this. So I have a few questions that I ask everybody.
Okay.
Don't think about them too hard. First answer that comes into your head, have you ever cried in the walk-in?
No.
Have you seen other people cry in the walk-in?
Yes.
Why the walk-in?
You feel safe in that area. You feel safe in that zone. You're separated. I've seen people like scream and freak out, you know, in the walk-in, you know, just like from frustration, just go into walk-in, like literally yell.
Yeah.
You know, ah!
Yeah, because, like, you know, the sides of beep can't hear you. Like, so have you cried at work, though?
No. Never.
That's just one of those things. And people either they do or they don't. Weirdly, a lot of people cry in the walk-in, it seems
I do, yeah.
Yeah. So what is the hardest job in a restaurant?
Oh, dishwasher.
I hear that a lot. And why is that?
I mean, I think it's not a very respected job in a sense of, you know, so it's a lot of work and it's normally a person that's making less money than other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're ultimately like responsible for a lot. I mean, we spend a lot of money on china and glassware, you know, and they have to go and like feed the line with the different plates and stuff like that and work with everything. So if you're a chef, I think if I go to a new kitchen, the first person I'm talking to is a dishwasher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm trying to relate to them in their language and show them like that we're cool and like, you know, that because I respect what they do.
Yeah. No,
I started there.
Yeah. I think that's so wonderful. And that really does give you that grounding in a kitchen.
Yeah.
So my colleague Meg Soul is working on this series asking chefs, like, what is your go-to cookbook? So give me like an older cookbook that you've relied on and then something in the past couple of years that you've been like, oh, yeah, this belongs in the canon.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Great Chefs of France is one of the one cookbooks that, like, I've read over and over again. If I've ever seen it in, like, a shop or whatever, I pick up the copy of it. I've given it to a lot of different chefs that have worked for me. Yeah, so that is probably the one. L'Atelier de Alain Ducasse, the French Laundry cookbook, of course.
Oh, yeah.
So those are kind of like my old school ones that I used to kind of go back to over and over again. Atelier was like really inspiring to me because it showed Ducasse's like four chefs of, you know, that were, you know, basically had development to their own chefs and like, you know, running restaurants. He gave them credit. Like it was like, I thought that was a really, really cool thing. Marco Pierre White, White Heat, like just the culture of kitchens back in that rock star sort of mentality.
Man. I could go on about, I could go on about him.
And then now, you know, I think, you know, surprisingly, I would say not because it's not a good book, obviously, but like the Ottolini cookbook and stuff like that. I think those books are.
Oh, it's a hell of a book. Modern classic.
Yeah. I think those books, they did a really, really good job because I can pick it up and I can be inspired by it. Mm-hmm. I can give it to my wife or my sister and they can cook from it.
Yeah.
And I think to have the ability to to reach such a broad audience. Mm-hmm. Like if I write a cookbook, I want the success of that. That's like really, really amazing. I think the job that they did.
Yeah, definitely. And that is a spectacular cookbook. Mm-hmm. What is your comfort food?
Comfort food. I mean, I love roasted chicken. I love potatoes. Right. I make it weekly. I mean, it's just something that
I cook a lot of chickens.
Yeah, except my wife was like, she did like, you know, you have food aversions or food like things that basically are not appealing to you when you're pregnant. And like chicken was like the thing this past pregnancy. And I was like, I can't do this anymore.
It's so funny.
I haven't had chicken in so long.
He's slinking out of the house. What's going on here? And you're like sneaking off to make chicken. Yeah. Like somewhere.
Just like the smell of it makes me sick.
Oh, my God. People do get those things. What is the last meal that you had that made you emotional?
That's a good question. I mean, my meal at Stone Barns was pretty amazing.
Going there tonight. Yeah. I'm so excited.
Yeah. I mean, I just think it brought me to a place I grew up in restaurants. I mean, it's hard to be inspired sometimes, you know, and you go and it's like a lot of work to go to a restaurant and you're thinking, you're looking at service.
And they're going to bomb you too.
But I think, you know, their philosophy and what they do is like really, really inspiring.
Yeah, it is. I'm so geeked to go there tonight. What's the last meal that somebody cooked for you in their home?
I mean, I'm very fortunate. My mother-in-law cooks. She's an amazing cook. So my wife is Lebanese, so she makes a lot of Middle Eastern food.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she makes like wana enab. So she'll make this weekend, tomorrow actually, she's going to make for my birthday and for my wife's sister's birthday, she's going to make arayas, which is like I think she'll do it with ground beef, but ground beef, like onions, garlic, a little chili, and like in between pita, and like they grill it on an open fire, which is really delicious.
Come over.
Yes. A lot of my friends will come up and be like, you have to try my mother-in-law's food. Like, it's like so delicious.
That sounds so good.
I mean, she's like she makes, it's like rolled cabbage, like stuffed cabbage leaves, kind of like a dolma, essentially. It's like literally one of my favorite things. It's like got that and like whole garlic. She steams it. You put like a ton of lemon over the top of it when you're done. I think a little dried thyme is what she puts in there as well. But you know, I love going and learning. I told her my wife cooks, but like she cooks because I've trained her to cook,
right.
You know, but she like was never, you know, she never cooked. You know, her mom didn't teach her how to cook or anything like that. And I'm like, tell her mom, I'm like, you will teach my kids how to cook. Like you have to teach them these dishes have to live on.
Yes, they absolutely do. Oh, I love that so much.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I want all of this. This is amazing. What living musician who you have never cooked for before would you want to cook for, and what would you make for them?
Living musician?
Because otherwise everybody's like wilding out on like Prince and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I would say, you know what? That's a good question. I was asked recently, that's the same question. I think I came up with a different answer, but I would say maybe Damien Rice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, like getting into that creative mindset, I kind of like to go to like a sad place, you know? And I think it brings out like emotions and stuff like that. And so I love listening to his music.
I can't hear Blower's Daughter without weeping. So yeah. that's him, right?
Like, yeah. So, I love listening to him. So what would I make for him? I don't know. I think I would. That's a tough question. I mean, he's, you know, I think he's English, so I would stay away from English food because I don't love it as much. But I would maybe make him a roast chicken. You know, I think just anything that you put love into, you know, I think is going to resonate with somebody. I would probably try to do a little bit of research about like what he liked and what he didn't like and stuff like that.
I
think anything when I cook for somebody, I want it to be. I think it's really, really special if that dish that you make brings them back to another, you know, memory. Yeah. I think that like kind of really resonates and reinforces that meal. So if I have that ability, that, you know, I would try to take advantage of that.
I love that. Final question.
Yeah.
You have 5 uninterrupted minutes for self-care, like no phone, you know, the kids are safe, everybody's happy. What do you do?
Take a bath.
Yeah. What's your bath style?
Epsom salt.
Yeah. That's very chefy of you, too. That's like, lets everything go. And yeah. Like, do you listen to music? Do you like deck out the room?
I will sometimes put like the Epsom, like there's like a bubble bath-ish thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I actually take a bath a lot with my they're getting a little older now, but like I took about a lot of baths with my kids.
Yeah.
You know, so I would study and be like, okay, is Epsom salt okay for kids? Whatever. Yeah. Okay, it's good. Like whatever. So I would, you know, I'd jump in a bath and spend time with them. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, even like yesterday I had time between meetings and stuff like that. I like ran a bath in the hotel and
yeah.
I was they had like a really nice bathtub. And I was like, oh man, I got to take a bath.
That is so lovely. And you got to relax because you got a restaurant to open.
Yeah, so.
Oh my gosh. So I know you're a busy man, so I'm so thankful for your time. How can people find you on social media?
At Chef Tim Hollingsworth on Instagram, yeah.
Yeah, and then, okay, let's go through the list of restaurants again. So if people want to come and find you.
Yeah, come to Odeum in downtown L.A., CJ Boyd's and Free Play, close by USC where Bank of California Stadium is. And then I'll be up in San Francisco very soon. Union Square, Gary and Mason will be called all these years.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah,
thank you for having me. Yeah. Thank you so much to my guests from, well, today, but also from months and months ago, Tim Hollingsworth. And you can find him at timhollingsworth.com and find out everything that he is up to. His Instagram is a truly lovely thing if you need a little bit of sunshine in your day. And yeah, who couldn't use some of that right now? It's you know, like I said up at the top, it's been a really, really challenging time for a lot of people. And I can't urge you enough to, if there is somebody in your life who you want to connect with and haven't done so for a while, even if you can't do it in person, get on Zoom, get on the phone, get on something and eat together that way, make a meal together that way, connect, just connect, because you never know when you're going to get to again. I think we're all living in a time when we realize we can't take a whole lot of the things for granted that we did before, whether it's seeing a loved one, going out to a restaurant that makes you smile, to gather in person to make that dish. Hey, you know that dish that you have been meaning to get from your relative for a long time. Now, even if you can't see this person, and especially as the holidays are coming up, consider connecting with them on a video chat or on the phone or something and walk through it. Get every step, record their voice, write it down so you have that. And so you can, you know, really always have that memory of making it with them. These things can be lost forever. The person, the food, the memories sorry to get all maudlin, but take it all down right now because you don't know when you're going to get to again. And as for the restaurant part of it, I do have hope with people like Tim, who is, you know, given his life over to restaurants and serving people and making this kind of food. There's no way that he won't come out of this with some kind of new perspective and you know, way of feeding people. And you know, he's one of thousands and thousands and thousands of chefs and restaurateurs out there who are trying to figure it out, and I have to have full faith that they will. And these are the conversations that we're having with people all the time on Food and Wine Pro, which I mentioned at the top. That is the section of Food and Wine that in print and in on the website at foodandwine.com/FWPro. And when we are all allowed to assemble in person again, it is also in-person events where we're really drilling down on the things that are important to the people who actually work in this industry that we love so much. We get into the nitty gritty of it, what people are doing business-wise, mental health-wise, you know, to physically, in terms of safety in all the different ways that that means, what they're doing with their finances, what they're doing with their business plans, what they're doing to keep themselves and their employees safe and their customers safe during this pandemic. So please take a look at that and sign up for the newsletter, which comes out on Fridays at noon, written by our editor-in-chief, Hunter Lewis, with an assist from me and from our associate restaurant editor, Osette Babur, with a special mantra from the Test Kitchen's amazing Kelsey Youngman, who is a certified meditation instructor. We include her words of wisdom in there every week, along with exclusive interviews and links to all the stories that we've done and that we have seen around the web about what is going on in the industry. Sign up and it'll just show up for you there. It's just going to be there for you. And we appreciate your eyes and your ears on this. You know what? I really like doing this podcast. It's really helped keep me connected during this time. And I want to thank Antara Sinha for being our incredible new producer on this show and putting up with my wobbliness over the past few months as we've been trying to figure out how to navigate these times and record this remotely. Got a new microphone this week. Hopefully that will help some. Thank you, Antara. Thank you to Sarah Crowder for always pulling together the images for this. Thank you to the whole Food in One team for letting us do this. And you know what? If you like listening to this podcast, it really helps people find us. If you like it if you like it, share those stars, drop a review, send the link to someone and share it with them as well, so we can spread the word, pop up in those search results, and keep on doing this thing that we really love to do. And you know what? If there's somebody who you think that we should be hearing from, who you think would be, just has a really great perspective and who you would like to see or rather hear on this podcast, I'm easy to find. I'm kat.kinsman@foodandwine.com. I am Kitten with a Whip on Twitter, and just hit me up. Let me know who you think has a really special voice and who we should be listening to. Most importantly, I say this every podcast, but I really, really especially mean it now. Take good care of yourself. Until the next time.